Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with your politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And so you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know, even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
But you say, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again, this time on the near side, for another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package gonna go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Japanese planes were swooping down on Pearl Harbor. This pictorial record includes both U.S. films and pictures made by the enemy as they dropped their load of death on the naval base, on Wheeler Field, on civilian homes and schools. 100 Japanese planes and a number of midget submarines took part in the attack. In an hour and 5 minutes, the battleship Arizona.
Gentlemen, we're standing by for further word from Honolulu, and we expect to rejoin them in just a moment. However, here's the bulletin which has just come in from the entrance to Honolulu, New York. From Europe, Japanese ambassador and Kurutsu, the special Japanese envoy, were at the State Department at the time when the White House announced that the attacks on Hawaii. The two Japanese went to the Secretary of State Hall at 1:35 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and remained about 20 minutes. Back in New York City, here's the bulletin. Honolulu, Japanese bomb killed at least 5 persons and injured many others, 3 seriously, in a surprise morning aerial attack.
Evacuation. More than 100,000 men, women, and children, all of Japanese ancestry, removed from their homes in the Pacific Coast states to wartime communities established in out-of-the-way places. Their evacuation did not imply individual disloyalty, but was ordered to reduce a military hazard at a time when danger of invasion was great. Two-thirds of the evacuees are American citizens by right of birth. The rest are their Japanese-born parents and grandparents. The people are not under suspicion. They are not prisoners. They are not internees. They are merely dislocated people, the unwounded casualties of war. The entire community, bounded by a wire fence and guarded by military police, symbols of the military nature of the evacuation. They know what they're fighting against, and they know what they're fighting for. Their country, and for the American ideals that are part of their upbringing. Democracy, freedom, equality of opportunity, regardless of race, creed, or ancestry.
Camps officially began to close. Going home was the next challenge.
They felt that they would be greeted with hostile neighbors and so forth. And word also came back that many of their farms had in fact been destroyed, torched by people.
For all the fear of sabotage that led to internment, by the end of World War II, not a single person of Japanese ancestry in the United States had even been accused of sabotage.
The wounds were so deep that the Japanese American community refused to discuss the internment for many years. In the late 1960s, during the Civil Rights Movement, a reparations movement emerged. Yet it took two decades before Japanese Americans took legal action in two different kinds of lawsuits to support the reparations movement. The first lawsuit in 1983 was the Coram Novus litigation. It was initiated by Fred Korematsu, Gordon Hirabayashi, and Min Yasui, who had been convicted during World War II for refusing to be interned.
Nami and his team brought the Korematsu case back to federal court under a motion that is rarely used and almost never successful, Coram Nobis.
Which was a rare legal procedure allowing the reopening of old cases of current importance. The Supreme Court had said at the time that the internment was constitutional because military necessity justified it. 40 years later, the Coram Nobis proceedings sought reversal of their convictions based on startling government World War II documents. Those documents revealed the following. 1. Before the internment, all government intelligence services involved in the issue at the time had determined that West Coast Japanese Americans as a group posed no serious danger and that there was no basis for mass internment. 2. The military based its internment decision on ambiguous racial stereotypes about Japanese Americans. 3. The Department of Justice and the Department of War concealed and destroyed key evidence that deliberately misled the Supreme Court and fabricated the military necessity justification for the internment.
Fred Korematsu waited 40 years before he got the chance to clear his name. He joined up with a team of young lawyers led by Dale Manami.
Courts must be allowed to function even during times of crises and should not be subjugated to the will of an arbitrary military decision maker.
Based on this evidence, the federal courts in the Coram Novus cases found manifest injustice, overturned the convictions of Korematsu, Hirabayashi, and Yasui cases, and thereby laid the legal foundation for reparations.
I had to do some real deep thinking in order to reopen this case again, and I am very happy that I did, because this is not only for just the Japanese-American citizens, but it's for all American citizens.
The second suit was a class action damages lawsuit, Hori versus United States, which was filed by former internees to obtain compensation for the material and psychological harms of the internment. Although the courts ultimately dismissed that case because it was filed too long after the events, the suit led to a greater public awareness and education about the real internment story. The reparations movement gained moral force from former internees and Asian American organizations, together with a wide range of groups, including civil liberties groups, the NAACP, churches, veterans, and labor associations, and even local governments. This support helped Asian American members of Congress from California and Hawaii to push through legislation creating the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians. The Commission's 1983 report, Personal Justice Denied, concluded that the causes of the internment were racial prejudice, wartime hysteria, and failure of political leadership.
In 1988, Congress passed the Civil Liberties Act, which not only apologized for the internment, but paid each survivor of the camps $20,000. The act was signed by President Ronald Reagan and sponsored by Congressman Norman Mineta.
The legislation that I am about to sign provides for a restitution payment to each of the 60,000 survivors, surviving Japanese Americans of the 120,000 who were relocated or detained. Yet no payment can make up for those lost years. So what is most important in this bill has less to do with property than with honor. For here we admit a wrong. Here we reaffirm our commitment as a nation to equal justice under the law. Thank you all again, and God bless you all. I think this is a fine day.
Most important for many Japanese Americans, the act called for a formal presidential apology. It also authorized reparations of $20,000 for each surviving internee who was a U.S. citizen or legal resident immigrant at the time of internment. The purpose of the Civil Liberties Act of 1988 with respect to persons of Japanese ancestry included the following. 1. To acknowledge the fundamental injustice of the evacuation, relocation, and internment of citizen and permanent resident aliens of Japanese ancestry during World War II. 2. To apologize on behalf of the United States for the evacuation, internment, and relocation of such citizens and permanent residing aliens. 3. To provide a public education fund to finance efforts to inform the public about the internment so as to prevent the recurrence of any similar event. 4. To make the restitution to those individuals of Japanese ancestries who were interned. And 5. To make more credible and sincere declarations of any concern by the U.S. over violation of human rights committed by other nations.
The Office of Redress Administration, created by the Act, implemented the reparations program. The Act authorized the ORA to identify, register, verify, and administer reparation payments to eligible individuals within a 10-year period. The ORA worked effectively with the National Coalition for Redress Reparations and the Japanese American Citizen League to provide information about reparations through Japanese American newspapers, community meetings, and newsletters. Former internees submitted over 60,000 reparation applications as a result of these collective efforts. The 1988 Act also established the Civil Liberties Public Education Fund to sponsor research and public educational activities to publish and distribute the hearings, findings, and recommendations of the Commission. Public education became a major dimension of redress. Projects sponsored by the Education Fund produce high school, college, and law school curricula on the internment and civil liberties, documentaries on internment camp life, oral histories of survivors, and the new research on the accommodation of national securities and civil liberties. The redress of wrongs committed against Japanese Americans was about much more than money. The Civil Liberties Act recognized the United States' grave injustice against its own citizens on account of their race, and it acknowledged the need to repair lasting wounds both to Japanese Americans and to the Constitution. In Woodland, Washington, Allen Northrop was arrested and sentenced for the rape and kidnapping of a housekeeper and was sentenced to 23 years in prison, leaving behind his family. Detectives believed the victim's story, even though she was blindfolded for most of her attack. Northrop tried to prove his innocence and in 2000 contacted the Innocence Project Northwest at the University of Washington School of Law in Seattle. For years, prosecutors denied their project's request to use more advanced DNA testing on the evidence in Northrop's case until 2005, when a new state law gave judges the power to order additional testing. However, it took another 5 years for Northrop's testings to be completed and for the court to consider. In 2010, Northrop received a letter that finally granted his release. He walked out of prison a few months later, but because he was convicted in Washington, like 23 other states across the country, Washington provides no compensation for those who have been wrongfully convicted. Northrop left prison with less than $2,500. He had been convicted in one of the 27 states that do not provide compensation. Northrop could have received hundreds of thousands of dollars for his 17 years behind bars. According to the Innocence Project study, Northrop is among the 40% of exonerated prisoners nationwide who have received nothing. The reports call for all states to pass laws providing the same compensation that the federal government offers to federal crimes, $50,000 for each year spent on death row. James said it's not all about money. It's about possible counseling for certain individuals.
And what you go through in there mentally is just traumatic. It's something that's not even fathomable. It's not right.
I am a Filipino soldier here in the foxhole or in the trench, in the front line. American also is here. We fought side by side with the same uniform, with the same dangers and bullets. We are facing the Japanese. That is what we call fought side by side with the U.S. Army soldiers under the U.S. flag.
After the war was won in 1945, a U.S. law denied most Filipino soldiers U.S. veteran status, preventing them from receiving benefits such as medical care and a pension.
The Americans promised it, but it never came. Some of us have gone to America to ask the government for recognition. I went to America many years ago, but came back empty-handed.
Now, more than 60 years later, the United States Congress finally passed a bill for $198 million in compensation to the estimated 20,000 living Filipino veterans. Beda Carrion, who endured aching legs to apply for the one-time lump sum payment of $9,000, described it as a victory he thought would never come.
We have waited so long for this. Sometimes, all these years of waiting, I felt disgusted about America's attitude. Can you imagine how long it took them? There used to be more than 30 veterans in this area, but now only 5 are left.
But with their advanced age and poor health, some worry they still would not live to see the day when a check finally arrives. They say time is running out.
All right, today we're taking a look at, we're continuing from yesterday. Today's podcast is titled Reparations Blueprint, the Civil Liberties Act of 1988. Once again, Reparations Blueprint, Civil Liberties Act of 1988. We're taking a look at a group of people, Japanese Americans, that were... Well, you're hearing it from yourselves. Were interred by the federal government of the United States, and what so you're hearing from Japanese Americans who it took them 40 years, but they got their reparations. So let's take a listen to what they're doing or what they did.
Hi, I'm Stacy Toji, and I serve on Gopalville National Education Center's Board of Directors. August 10th marks the 32nd anniversary of the passing of the Civil Liberties Act, the legislation that provided an official presidential apology and monetary redress for surviving Japanese Americans who were affected by Executive Order 9066. We're happy to present to you today Dr. Mitch Mockey, president of Gopher Broke National Education Center, and his presentation on the redress movement. I still remember the day when my grandmother told me about the check she received 40 years after being released from Gila River concentration camp. And yet, I still don't fully understand all that went into the redress movement and this unprecedented legislation. So, please enjoy this presentation. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mitch Mockey, president of Gopher Broke National Education Center. We are a nonprofit organization which tells the story of the Japanese American soldiers of World War II, of their courage, their valor, and their sacrifice as they upheld America's promise. The promise that in this nation, no one is to be judged by the color of their skin, the nation of their origin, or the God whom they choose to worship. Let me tell you a story of a small, disenfranchised community that became the victim of one of the most egregious violations of our Constitution, and then found the courage and the voice to demand an apology and acknowledgement from the United States government. December 7, 1941, the Imperial Nation of Japan attacks Pearl Harbor, and it thrusts the United States into World War II. Japanese Americans immediately began to wonder what would happen to us. Would we be treated like the American citizens we were, two-thirds of whom had been born here in the United States, the other third having lived here for 30, 40, and 50 years? Or would we be treated like the enemy because we shared a common ancestry? We received our answer 2 months later, on February 19, 1942, when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which created the underpinnings by which nearly 120,000 individuals of Japanese ancestry, two-thirds of whom were American citizens by birth, would be forcibly excluded from the West Coast and made to spend the next 3 to 5 years of their lives living behind barbed wire. We lost our homes. We lost our jobs, we lost our communities, but most of all, what was lost was a sense of place at the American table of citizenship. While living in these camps, Japanese Americans were forced to live in communal surroundings, in desolate areas surrounded by barbed wire and machine gun towers. Worst of all, they were deprived of their constitutional rights. And then a curious thing happened about a year into the camp experience. The U.S. Army, realizing that the war effort was going poorly, decided that they needed more men to go and fight in Europe. They came up with the idea of creating a segregated Japanese-American unit. Imagine the angst and the anxiety as these young men, boys really, 18, 19 years of age, were asked to fight for their nation, the United States of America, put themselves in harm's way, and possibly die for liberty and justice halfway across the world, while their own families were being imprisoned behind barbed wire. The issue tore the community apart, as families struggled over whether they would allow their sons to go and fight, or whether they encouraged their sons to resist. At first, the decision was a voluntary one, and then it became a decision as to whether to cooperate or resist the mandatory draft orders. Despite the paradoxical nature of the choice, thousands of young Japanese Americans from the territory of Hawaii, as well as out of these camps, said, "Send me." They would go on to become the most decorated unit of their size in American military history. In Europe, they were known as the 100th Battalion and the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. These young soldiers were awarded 8 presidential citations, 21 medals of honor, and nearly 9,500 Purple Hearts. The medal you receive when you're either wounded or killed. In the Pacific Theater, Japanese Americans also serve as interrogators, intelligence officers, and linguistic experts, and were credited with helping to end the war in the Pacific 2 years earlier than otherwise would have happened. Why? Why did these young men choose to go? Why did they choose to put themselves in harm's way, knowing that their own families were deprived of these same liberties? The best answer comes from a young sergeant named Kazuo Masuda. His answer was the answer that many of these young Japanese American soldiers would have given. When asked why he was doing this, his response was, "Because this is the only way that I know that my family can have a chance in America." Right or wrong, agree with him or not, Sergeant Masuda and the thousands of other young Japanese American soldiers understood that in 1943, 1944, and 1945, loyalty needed to be demonstrated in blood. 1945 comes, and with it, the end of the war, and the camps begin to close. Japanese Americans are given $25 and a one-way train ticket to go and reestablish their lives. On the top of the list was, let's get a job, let's find a place to live, let's put food on the table, let's send our kids back to school, let's rebuild our community. But there was another feeling, a feeling of shame, a feeling that somehow we had done something to bring this terrible tragedy upon us. The best analogy that I can give you is that of a sexual assault victim or an incest survivor who had something terrible happen to them through no fault of their own, but they blame themselves. If only I had said this, if only I had done that, if only, if only, if only. Japanese Americans felt that if they had been more American, this would never have happened to us. Japanese Americans felt that they needed to be 110% American so that this tragedy would never happen to us again. The 1950s come, and with it, the beginning of change in America. 1952, we have the McCarran-Walters Act, which allows Japanese immigrants to naturalize for the very first time. 1954, we have Brown versus Board of Education, which says that separate but equal is no longer the law of the land. The civil rights movement begins in the 1950s. And in 1959, something occurs which sets the foundation by which someday the Japanese American community might be acknowledged by the federal government. What happens in 1959 is that Hawaii becomes a state. And with statehood comes representation. In fact, the very first U.S. representative from the now new state of Hawaii was a young man named Daniel K. Inouye. Daniel K. Inouye was a member of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, and he lost his right arm in battle, fighting for his nation. What better symbol of loyalty to send to Congress than somebody like Representative Inouye? The 1960s come along, and the 60s is a time of great change. The civil rights movement is in full bloom. The women's movement has captured the imagination of young people across the United States. The anti-war movement is teaching young people how to say, "Hell no, I won't go." And dissent becomes viewed as an American value. Ethnic studies movement is taking place in universities, and young people begin to look at their own history. For young Asian Americans, Japanese Americans in particular, they look back and said, "What happened? Why did my parents go to these camps? Why didn't they resist? We would have resisted." And they begin to look at their parents and grandparents through the lens of cowardice and accommodation. But still, the Japanese American community was a long ways away from wanting to demand redress and reparations for what had happened during World War II. As an example, in 1963, There was a professor named Roger Daniels who taught a history class at UCLA. One of his first assignments was for his students to write an autobiography. Dr. Daniels had two young Japanese-American students in his class. Both of them began their autobiographies by saying, "I was born in 1943 in Los Angeles, blah, 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 blah." Dr. Daniels read this and immediately knew there was a problem. He called them into his office and he said, "There's a problem with your autobiographies." Immediately, both of them said, "We didn't cheat, Dr. Daniels. I mean, how do you cheat on an autobiography?" Dr. Daniels said, "That's not what I'm talking about. Take your autobiographies home. Show them to your folks. Come back and see me." Sure enough, the next day, one of the young students came back to see Dr. Daniels. And he said, "You're right, Dr. Daniels. I shared my autobiography with my parents. I was born in 1943, but not in Los Angeles. I was born in Manzanar, a concentration camp." The pain, the shame, the wanting to forget was so powerful for some that they didn't even tell their own children the truth about the incarceration. The 1970s come into play, and with it, more representation for Japanese Americans in the U.S. Congress. By now, Representative Inouye is now Senator Dan Inouye. In 1974, Norman Mineta, the mayor of San Jose, is elected to the House of Representatives. Norm was a 10-year-old boy when he and his family were sent off to Heart Mountain concentration camp in Wyoming. In 1976, Spark Matsunaga becomes senator from the state of Hawaii. Senator Matsunaga was also a member of the 100th Battalion and a decorated war veteran. And in 1978, Robert Matsui was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives from Sacramento, California. Robert Matsui was a six-month-old baby when he and his family were sent off to Tule Lake concentration camp. So, by the end of the 70s, we now had two decorated war veterans in the Senate and two former inmates of American concentration camps in the House of Representatives. But the community was still split as to how it felt about pursuing redress. Basically, there were three trains of thought. The first group said, "Let it go. It happened a long time ago, and we are doing much better. Don't make me tell those stories. Don't make me feel that pain. Don't make me go through those feelings again." It was primarily the elderly who felt this way. The second group said, "No. What happened to us was wrong, and we are deserving of an apology. Just give us a good, clean apology. Don't give us money." And there was a very pragmatic part to this perspective. The United States had never granted an apology nor monetary reparations to any group. So let's not overreach. But there was also a very principled reason. "Don't insult me. Don't take away my constitutional rights, throw a few dollars my way, and say everything is okay. Don't put a price tag on my civil liberties. Just give me a good, clean apology." But the third group said, "Wait a second. Yes, what happened to us was wrong, and we are deserving of an apology. But there were real losses. People lost their homes, their jobs, their businesses. There were real losses, and there needs to be money attached to this bill. Give us an apology and give us money so that we know that this apology is authentic." This debate tore the community apart in the 70s until finally in 1978, the Japanese American Citizens League, the largest Japanese American civil rights organization, passed its most strongly worded resolution. "We demand a presidential apology. And along with that apology, we want monetary reparations in the form of individual payments and community payments." Over the next 10 years, the Japanese-American community engaged in a battle to make the story of the Japanese-American incarceration one that American legislators understood. It started with a commission hearing, the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians in the early 80s. And then the battle migrated to the Congress, to the halls of the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate. Finally, on September 17, 1987, the bill hits the floor of the House of Representatives. This day was chosen specifically as it was the 200th anniversary of the signing of the U.S. Constitution. And on that day, the impossible dream of obtaining an apology and monetary redress payments from the nation passes the House of Representatives. 243 representatives, 180 of them were Democrats, 63 of them were Republicans. It was truly a bipartisan effort. 7 months later, the bill hits the floor of the U.S. Senate, and we knew it would pass because Senator Matsunaga had personally lobbied every one of the other 99 U.S. senators. And by the time it hit the floor of the Senate, there were 71 co-sponsors. So now we needed only one more supporter, one more signature, and that would be the President of the United States. For those of you who remember, in 1988, that president was none other than Ronald Reagan, a very conservative president whose own administration had been fighting against this bill, both in the Congress as well as in the courts. Many of us thought that there was no way on God's green earth that Ronald Reagan would sign this bill. For those of you who remember Ronald Reagan, whether you agreed with his policies or not, most people would agree that Ronald Reagan was a great communicator. He had the ability to tell stories that would touch people's hearts and move them in a certain direction. Well, the opposite was true of Ronald Reagan. If you could tell him a story that would touch his heart, you could have a great advocate on your hands. So now the question was, what story could we tell Ronald Reagan that would help him understand on a personal level the significance of this bill? Well, remember I told you about Sergeant Kazuo Masuda, the young Japanese-American soldier who said that he was fighting because it was the only way that he knew that his family could have a chance in America. 2 weeks after saying that, Sergeant Masuda was killed in battle, fighting for his nation, the United States of America. After the war, his family moves back to Santa Ana, California, only to be met with racial taunts, hate speech, and threats of bodily harm. The Army, realizing that this is a PR fiasco, that the family of one of its own heroes can't move back home, sends out a contingent of Army officers to have a medal ceremony for the Masuda family. That night, at the convention dinner, there was a young, white American captain who addressed the audience. His name was Ronald Reagan. Captain Reagan addressed the audience by saying, "The blood that is soaked into the sands is all of one color. America stands unique in the world, the only nation not founded on race, but on an ideal. Mr. and Mrs. Masuda, as one member of the American family to another, for what your son Kazuo did, thanks." That story was relayed to President Reagan in the 80s, and his response was, "I remember that family, and I remember what those soldiers did for America." On August 10th, 1988, President Ronald Reagan signed the Civil Liberties Act, providing a presidential apology, $20,000 in individual monetary reparations, and a $50 million trust fund for all those affected by Executive Order 9066. It was a very proud moment, not just for Japanese Americans, but for all Americans who cherished the Constitution and the values of our nation. Now, as I leave you here today, lest any of us feel that justice has been permanently secured, let me leave you with the words of the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Before his death, Justice Scalia stated that what happened to the Japanese Americans was wrong, but that you are kidding yourself if you think it will never happen again. In times of war, the laws fall silent. In times of war, the laws fall silent. Very chilling words for all of us who cherish the Constitution and the liberties which it presents to us. So as we end here today, I hope you will join me in committing ourselves to never again allowing in our nation our laws to fall silent. Thank you for spending this time with me.
Wow, what a wonderful presentation. And I'm lucky enough to be sitting here with Dr. Mitch Maki, one of the preeminent scholars on the history of redress. So, Mitch, thank you so much for putting that video together.
It was my pleasure.
For me, you know, someone who wasn't alive when the redress movement was happening, it was really eye-opening to see all that went into the movement. And, you know, for those of us who weren't around, I do have a couple of questions, if you don't mind me asking. And in the video, you mentioned the individuals who wanted redress to happen. You know, they fell into one of three distinct camps of thought. But it seemed like the third camp, which wanted the apology as well as money for what they lost during the war, they're the ones who won out. So what was the response after this $20,000 check was granted to detainees from the first two philosophies?
It was such a tremendous victory for our community. That was the foremost thought of most people, regardless of how you felt beforehand, you know, that, my goodness, our nation recognized what happened to our community, recognized that egregious violation, and said, I'm sorry. And really, it wasn't necessarily the money. It was the apology that just filled most Japanese Americans, if not all Japanese Americans, who were affected by Executive Order 9066, with a sense of recognition, atonement, and a sense of validation that what had happened was wrong. You know? And the truth is, $20,000 didn't change people's lives. It was a symbolic amount, you know, that was meant to acknowledge what happened, right? And you hear stories of, you know, some families donated their monies, some families put it away for a college education for their grandchildren or whatnot. Only a small handful of people returned the money or refused the money. I mean, a very small number. But I think the one story that I'm reminded of is that in Los Angeles, a friend of mine, Ron Wakabayashi, who was the executive director of the JACL at the time, was at the local bank the days after the checks started to roll out, and he saw long lines of mostly Issei at that time depositing their checks. You know? And he said he was filled with this sense of gratification, you know, that here the people who had suffered the most, who had lost the most, were now at least able to cash their checks. And he saw this one elderly woman cash her check. And as she was leaving, he went up to her and he said, oh, you know, congratulations. And what are you going to do with your money? You know, as he struck up the conversation with her. And she looked at him and gave him this big toothless smile and said, I'm buying teeth. And it was just a great example of everyone had their ideas of how they were going to celebrate this moment.
In fact, if I may tell a story of my own, my grandmother was interned at Gila River, and when she got out, she settled in Monterey. And years later, she had heard rumors that the Japanese Americans were going to be receiving redress. And so my grandfather urged her to go down to the Social Security office and just inquire about it. So she went down, and she met with one of the employees who was a Hakujin man. She said about my age, about 30 years old. And she said, excuse me, sir, you know, I heard that the Japanese Americans were going to be receiving about 20,000. And he said, ma'am, why would the government give you so much money? And she said, well, you know, because of the camps. And he said, what camps? And she said, well, you didn't know that they put us in camps during the war? And he had no idea. So for her, I mean, there was no malice. He really didn't know. He was just naive in that sense. So do you find that there was that sort of response to Japanese American internment? Do you find that there are other individuals out there who have never heard of internment or redress?
True in 1988, you know, and it is true to this day when I lecture on this. People will come up to me, young people, and say, I had no idea. I had no idea that Japanese Americans were incarcerated. I had no idea that Japanese American soldiers fought for our nation and died in such large numbers and sacrificed with such courage and patriotism. And then again, they had no idea that our nation, in a moment of true strength, looked at what they had done and said, we apologize for what had happened.
And with the Issei and Nisei, who were interned at the time, I know that you mentioned that they left camp with this innate feeling of not being American enough. And with people like my mom, for example, her middle name, her first name is Barbara, her middle name is Luis. And I think that was because, you know, when my grandma left camp, she wanted to assimilate, you know, as much as possible after the war. But then the Civil Liberties Act was passed, and suddenly there was this acknowledgement that the Japanese Americans were, in fact, wrongfully incarcerated. So do you think, because of the redress movement, there was kind of a resurgence of being a pride for being Japanese American, and do you think that's the reason why the Yonsei have middle names again, like Kimiko or Tsugio or Takeshi?
I think that plays a big part of it. You know, it really was validation for the community that we had done nothing wrong. We didn't bring this upon ourselves. This was a violation of the Constitution. And it also gave us a chance to look back at what our young men did as soldiers during World War II. You know, the Nisei soldiers who fought in Europe, the Nisei soldiers who fought and served in the Pacific Theater, and how they contributed to the war effort. And it also gave us an opportunity to look at the young men who resisted military participation, you know, the resistors during World War II, that they were well ahead of their time in understanding the power of dissent.
So you mentioned that the Sanseis really started to question the older generation and what was happening at the time. Do any specific examples come to mind?
In the late 60s, there were two activists, Warren Furutani, who many of us know and respect today, and Victor Shibata. And they, along with others, decided that they were going to create the first Manzanar pilgrimage, the first journey back to where the camps had happened, right? So Warren tells the story about how he and Victor jump in the car, they start driving up to 395, they're gonna go to Manzanar, and they get there, they get out of the car, they start scoping out the place. This white pickup truck comes driving up to them, and in Warren's words, this redneck guy with the gun rack and the cowboy hat starts looking at them and says, "What you boys doing?" The first thing you don't ever want to do is call Warren a boy, right? You know Warren Furutani, man. He opens his mouth, and he's like a slot machines and silver dollars start coming out of his mouth. And he says, "We are here to commemorate what happened to our people during World War II and to make sure that we don't forget and that the nation doesn't forget." And the guy starts laughing at Warren. Now, you know, after you've called Warren Furutani a boy, the second thing you don't want to do is start laughing in his face. And Warren says, "I was about to jump down his throat." And the guy says, "Well, if you boys are here for Manzanar, you're on the wrong side of the road. It's over there." In the late 60s, we didn't even know where the camps were, let alone the history of the camps. You know, so that there was so much still to learn. There was still so much more to still arm ourselves with in terms of an understanding of what really happened.
And I think for the younger generations, you know, we don't know what we don't know, which is why it's so important to have presentations such as yours and even books like the ones that you've written. So you wrote Achieving the Impossible Dream, How Japanese Americans Obtained Redress. So can you tell me a little bit about the book?
Well, first of all, I didn't write it by myself. I had two wonderful co-authors, the late Harry Kitano, who many people in the Asian American studies field know and revere. I mean, Harry was a giant in terms of Asian American studies. And at the time, a woman who was a doctoral student, Megan Berthold, who is now a professor in social work, and the three of us went on a journey together to write this book. This was in June of 1990, and I asked Harry, "How long will it take us to write this book?" And he says, "We'll be done by December." And I thought, oh my gosh, 6 months to write a book? Well, Harry was correct. We were done in December of 1999, 5 years later. And this truly was a labor of love that the three of us participated in. We traveled the country. We interviewed legislators, attorneys, activists. And I was filled with two feelings as I met all these people. The first feeling was a feeling of awe, a feeling of these individuals, who many of them were just average citizens in terms of their training and background, made this incredible journey, made this incredible piece of legislation possible. Simply awestruck by that. And the second feeling I had was envy. I was so envious. I wish I had been a part of that, you know, but I was a little bit young at that time, but envious of what these folks had accomplished.
Well, I look forward to reading the book. And you had mentioned Dr. Daniels, who again came up in the presentation, and I found it so interesting, the story that you told about, you know, how he had asked his students to write an autobiography, and, you know, they come to find out that where they thought they were born wasn't their actual true birthplace. So have you found other stories like that as well, where, you know, because of the pain and shame that internees felt, they didn't share or divulge any information with their children?
It was very commonplace that families did not talk about what happened during camp. And you talk to a lot of sanseis and who came up during that time, and they will tell you that when they heard their parents talking about camp, they thought they were talking about summer camp. You know, they thought literally they were talking about some resort during the summer that they would go to. They had no idea that it was a concentration camp, that it was a place that was surrounded by barbed wire and military towers. Even Bob Matsui used to talk about, as a young child, he had no idea that this had really happened, and that he, as a grade schooler, was in class, and his teacher said, "Bob, tell us about the camps during World War II. She knew about them, right? And he said, "Those never happened. That just didn't happen." Because in Bob's family at that time, they didn't talk about it. And as a result of that, there was a gap that started to develop. In 1978, the JACL passes its legislation or its resolution that says we want redress. And then early in 1979, they go and meet with the four legislators, you know, with Matsunaga, Inoue, Mineta, and Maga reportedly says, "Komatane," you know, big trouble, you know, because they understood, the legislators understood how this would be perceived as a ethnic-specific bill. This would be perceived as a special interest bill. And Senator Inoue even said at one point, he said, "If we carry this bill," you know, he had a very deep voice, and he was sitting right next to Bob Matsui, he puts his hand on Bob's shoulder, he says, "This young man won't be here in 2 years." They understood how difficult it would be to get this type of legislation passed without some validation of the wrong that had been committed. And Senator Inoue suggested that there should be a commission hearing to study the problem and then to issue findings regarding what had happened. And that was a risky proposition. Because what happens if they find against you? Or they say, yeah, the camps were a terrible thing, but they were justified because it was time of war. And the other reality was that in the late 70s, if we were to start a commission hearing, it might take 3 years or so for the commission to do its work, and then another year to write it up. It would be like 4 years before any findings came out. And in the late 70s, it was estimated that with every passing month, 200 elderly Issei were passing away. So for every month that we waited, justice delayed would be justice permanently denied. So it was a very tough decision. Do you go with this commission idea that the senator is putting forward? And yeah, his rationale was the American people don't remember what happened, and the American Congress don't remember what happened. And numerically, he was correct. There was only about 11 representatives and about 8 senators at that time who were still in office from World War II. So there wasn't an institutional memory of what happened to Japanese Americans. And ultimately, the decision was made, let's go forward with the commission hearing. And Once that decision was made, the Japanese-American community, it was the NCRR, the JACL, and other groups diligently to get people ready to testify. But imagine how threatening that is to your average Japanese-American. Remember, these are the people who weren't even telling their children about the camps, right? And now they were going to go before a federal commission and share their innermost secrets, their stories that they hadn't told to anyone else. And in Los Angeles, Ron Wakabayashi, the JACL executive director, put together a mock commission hearing. And he brought in 15 of the JACL chapter presidents. They were all men at the time, but they were all used to doing public speaking. And he would have them stand before this mock hearing of 9 commissioners and tell their story. The first guy gets up, starts to tell the story, breaks down crying. He can't get through it. Second guy gets up, starts telling his story, breaks down crying, can't get through it. Not one of those 15 chapter presidents who was used to doing public speaking could tell their story, because for all of them, it was the first time that they were speaking publicly about this history. Another friend of mine, Richard Katsuda, was working up in San Jose, and he was working with the elderly. He convinced about 6 elderly Issei to make that journey to go to San Francisco. And the person who was driving the van said, on the way, you could hear a pin drop in that van. They were petrified about what they were about to do. They sat there in silence, thinking about what it was that they were about to say to this federal commission. Well, they went to San Francisco. They testified in Japanese, and the translation was given to the commission. And on the way back, all you could hear was laughing and singing and them slapping each other on the back, because they had begun to face their demons. They had begun to tell the stories that they had kept bottled up for 40 years. Yeah. And I remember the hearings, because they came to Los Angeles and I was a college student at that time, and I said, I'm skipping class, I need to be there. And to be there in a room, and many of them Nisei, you know, rough and tough, hard to bluff, they don't show emotion, and to hear testimony after testimony after testimony, people sharing their losses, sharing what they went through. And at the end of the day, there was not a dry eye in the audience. The testimony at the hearings reflected the pain and the agony of the community. And one testimony that reflected that was the testimony of a gentleman named Kiyoshi Sonoda. And Kiyoshi Sonoda was a dentist by training. When he was first sent to camp, he was put in charge of the infirmary. And Dr. Sonoda told the story of his first patient, a young, dehydrated infant. And Dr. Sonoda said that under normal circumstances, he would be able to treat that baby and make him well. But because he didn't have the proper supplies and because there was no proper equipment, all he could do was hold that infant in his hands and feel his last twitch before he died. And as he told that story, Dr. Sonoda had tears streaming down his face. And in the audience, his wife is sitting there and she said, Kiyoshi is crying. Kiyoshi doesn't cry. Kiyoshi didn't even cry at his own father's funeral. And yet on that day, Dr. Sonoda did cry. And a room full of people cried with him. And I would contend that a community cried with him. As we, as the Japanese-American community, found the courage and the strength to finally tell our stories and to demand an apology. And as powerful as those testimonies were, I would submit to you that the more powerful testimonies occurred in people's homes, around dining room tables, in living rooms. As a sansei would look at their parents and their grandparents and say, tell us what happened. Is this what happened to you? And their parents and their grandparents would sometimes for the first time share the stories that they had not shared for decades. And then they would ask their Sansei children, can we really win this redress? Can we really get our own apology? And the answer was, we don't know, but we have to try. And the divide that I had talked about earlier began to heal as our generations began to understand what really happened in World War II and the need for us not to forget. And so that was an unintended consequence of the commission hearings. Certainly, it propelled the redress movement forward, but it healed us internally. The commission issued its findings in a document called Personal Justice Denied. And in that document, it said the camps were wrong and that the camps were the result of war hysteria, race prejudice, and a failure of political leadership. Very powerful words to aim at one of the presidents who was so popular at the time, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. From there, the redress legislative movement took off. The battle then went to Capitol Hill.
It's good to hear that on some level there was an understanding by the younger generation and vice versa of each other's viewpoints.
Certainly the Sansei can be credited with bringing energy and bringing questions, and you know, and they were young and so forth. But there were some Nisei, you know, who were right there. And I remember I was engaged with a number of people talking about who's the MVP of redress. That's a question that can never be answered. It's like asking who is the greatest baseball player of all time. But one name that consistently surfaces was of a Nisei, and that was Iko Herzog Yoshinaga. And Iko was not a legislator. Iko was not an attorney. Iko was not even a trained archivist. But she, with the help of her husband, Jack Herzog, would spend countless hours doing research in the Library of Congress, spending hours and hours going through documents. And she found incredible evidence that helped the commission hearing issue its findings. So again, the folks who made redress happen came from all generations, all genders, and all backgrounds. So let me ask you a question, Stacy. I'm going to give you four names. I think you're going to be familiar with all four names. They were all on the House floor on September 17th, 1987. One of them did not vote in favor of redress. I want you to tell me who it was. Robert Matsui, Dick Cheney, former vice president. He was a representative at that time, very conservative Republican. Newt Gingrich, also another very conservative Republican, and Norm Mineta. One of them did not vote in favor of redress.
It seems like a trick question.
Well, of course.
Yeah. You wouldn't be asking it if it wasn't Robert Matsui or Norm Mineta.
Okay, so I will help you. You're right. Dick Cheney voted for redress, and that surprises a lot of people, but Dick Cheney comes from Wyoming, where Heart Mountain was. He understood the concentration camp story, right? Newt Gingrich, another very conservative Republican, right, understood that this was about the Constitution. So that leaves Bob Matsui and Norm Mineta. One of them did not vote in favor of redress.
I'm going to go with Bob Matsui.
And you would be wrong.
Norm Mineta.
Bob Matsui voted in favor of redress. Norm Mineta did not vote in favor of redress. But here's why. He voted present because he felt it would be a conflict of interest for him to vote for a bill that would bestow $20,000 upon him. A very principled reason for why he did not vote in favor of the bill. Of course he favored the bill. Of course he advocated for the bill. Of course he lobbied for the bill. And the truth be told, he knew at that moment the bill was going to pass. And so I did ask him once, I said, Norm, what would you have done? You know, 435 votes in the House, 217, you're the last vote, what would you have done? And he just looked at me and said, I commit harakiri. But it's a great trivia question. Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's very interesting. And now that you've explained the rationale behind it, it definitely makes sense and is so in line with Nonnunetta's character.
And there are also stories of great fortune, essentially where we got lucky that things fell into place so that the bill can move forward. So, for example, in the 98th and 99th Congress, the bill on the House side could not get out of subcommittee because the chairs of the subcommittee just weren't excited about the bill. And it wasn't until the 100th Congress, through a series of happenstance, where the top two or three people who are going to be the chairs of that committee either get appointments elsewhere, become a judge someplace else, and so forth, that a young man by the name of Barney Frank becomes the chair of the subcommittee where the redress bill is held. Barney Frank was the only openly gay member of Congress at that time, and he understood discrimination. He understood oppression. And so when Matsui and Mineta found out that Barney Frank was going to be the chair, they got really excited and said, let's go see him. He saw them in the elevator one day, and he said, if you're coming to see me about your bill, don't worry about it. I'm passing it out of my committee.
Wow, that's a great story about Barney Frank. Do you have any other stories like that to share?
One story that I love to tell is that Norm Mineta was a 10-year-old Cub Scout when he was sent off to Heart Mountain, Wyoming. And there was a camping outing with the local white American Boy Scouts. And so Norm gets paired up with this young boy named Alan. And they're pitching their tent that day. And Alan says to Norm, the kid next to us, I really don't like him. And when you pitch a tent, you have to cut a moat around your tent. And then you cut a cutout, so that's where the water will flow out. So Alan says to Norm, can we cut it so that the water flows into that kid's tent? And Norm, being the mischievous boy he was, says, sure, let's do that. And that night, it starts to pour. And somewhere around midnight, they hear the swoosh as the tent next to them gets washed away, and Alan and Norm are just laughing their heads off. And that Alan grew up to become Alan Simpson, a very conservative Republican senator from the state of Wyoming. And normally, somebody like Alan Simpson may have not supported the Civil Liberties Act, you know, but because of his friendship with Norm, he understood, and he literally stayed out of the way so that the bill could pass the Senate. Again, you can't write a better script than that, but it actually happened.
So we've talked a bit about the veterans. Do you think that they were important in the passing of redress?
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. There was a man named Grant Ujifusa who worked for the JECL as their legislative lead, and he coined the phrase, no vets, no redress. Because it was clear that based on what the Japanese-American veterans of World War II did, you couldn't question the loyalty of the Japanese-American community. Senator Inouye would say all you had to do was refer to the veterans and kind of look at the legislator and say, and what did you do? It was an argument that almost made itself and spoke for itself. There's the story of a veteran by the name of Rudy Tokiwa. And there was a lobbying trip to Washington, D.C. And Rudy, along with two community activists, had an appointment to visit with a gentleman named Charles Bennett, a moderate Democrat from Florida. And Charles Bennett cuts him off and he says, you might as well leave. I'm not voting for any bill that makes my country apologize to anyone. Now, the thing about Rudy is that Rudy was wounded during World War II, and he walks on crutches. So he stays there for a second, and Charles Bennett looks at him and says, didn't you hear what I said? I'm not voting for your bill. Rudy says, I understand that, but I just wanted to thank you. And Charles Bennett says, thank me? I said I'm not voting for your bill. He says, that's not what I'm talking about. I want to thank you for your service to our nation as a congressperson, but also as a veteran who thinks of that damn bullet in your back every morning when you wake up the way I think about that damn bullet that's in my back. Rudy Tokiwa had done his homework. He knew that Charles Bennett was a wounded veteran. September 17th, the day it hits the House floor, both Representative Mineta and Representative Matsui go up to Charles Bennett during the argument, and they say, "Hey, do you see who's up in the rafters?" He looks up there in the rafters, in the handicapped section, with his army scarf on, with his canes as he's sitting there, staring at him, is Rudy Tokiwa. Now, I can't tell you what Charles Bennett thought in that moment, but I can tell you how Charles Bennett voted. He voted for redress. So that's a very tangible example of what the veterans did. But truly, their story, their patriotism, their sacrifice helped to convince people to vote for the bill, or at the very least, silence the opposition to the bill.
Wow. Their service went beyond just what they contributed in the war.
Yes,
wow.
Very much so.
The Redress Bill and the Civil Liberties Act really passed as a result of a courageous Japanese-American community and a lot of luck, you know, right place, right time. But you mentioned a quote by Justice Scalia, "In times of war, the law falls silent." Quote seems very relevant today. What is the takeaway from the redress movement?
I think there are several lessons. The first lesson that pops into my head is that we are blessed to live in a nation of law. We are blessed to live in a nation where we have, as individual citizens, the right to protest, the right to raise our voice and say, something is wrong and we need to change it and we need to address it. And in a nation of law, it's possible. But it's only possible if we remain vigilant, if we remain engaged, and if we remain active. And I think that's what Justice Scalia was talking about. The second thought is that justice is never secured. Maybe for the moment, but then as soon as that moment passes, we need to be vigilant to make sure that we stay engaged in keeping it alive and well. And I think the Japanese-American redress experience reflects the strength of our nation, the strength of our citizenry, the strength of our people, to be able to look at our history and to look at our values and say we need to continue to strive to live up to that.
So with everything we've talked about today, it's clearly evident that redress is very personal to you. So as the president of Go for Broke National Education Center, what does redress truly mean to you?
As president of Go for Broke, you know, we tell the story of our Japanese-American veterans of World War II. And these men, who are now in their 90s, are my heroes. They did for our community, and they did for our nation, a tremendous service of proving that being American isn't about the color of your skin or where your family comes from or what religion you are. It's a matter of the heart. And I know these guys, many of them came out of the camps to serve while their own families were behind barbed wire, denied the liberties they were supposedly going to fight and possibly die for halfway around the world. Other of these soldiers came from Hawaii, where they were treated as second-class citizens working on the plantation. My uncle was in Company E. You know, they had all the reason to say no, and yet they chose to be an American. And for them in particular, I think redress is a validation, their courage, of their sacrifice, and of their vision that America can be a place where their family, their son's generation, and their grandchildren can have a place in America. Last summer, I was in the Vosges Mountains with my daughter. And there was a veteran there, and his name was Lawson Sakai. And here we were halfway across the world in the middle of this dense forest where one of the most famous battles, the Battle for the Lost Battalion, occurred. And Lawson was describing the terrain and the tall trees where the Nazis would aim artillery so the trees would explode, and they were called tree bursts. And he explained how he was injured in that time, 75 years ago. So on one side was this hero, and on the other side was my Yonsei daughter, Lane, who's never had to question her place in America, who's never had to question her opportunities in America. And it was because of men like Lawson and his fellow soldiers. For them to receive redress, for them to know that their families received redress, is incredibly important to me. And when I speak to them, while they're very humble, I know that they're very proud. And as we all know, no vets, no redress.
Well, as much as you appreciate their courage and their sacrifice, I'm sure they equally appreciate the way that you're honoring their legacy and their story.
Thank you.
Powerful words about a powerful movement. Well, Mitch, I thank you so much for your time and your expertise, for sharing those with us today.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
And for those of you who'd like to tune in again, this interview and the presentation will be available on the Go for Broke National Education website, gopherbroke.org. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Couple of Japanese Americans chopping it up over reparations, Japanese American style. Today's podcast has been titled Reparations Blueprint Civil Liberties Act of 1988. This is part, let's call it part two. Tomorrow we'll go into part three, where we'll open it up to discussions. I got a class on solar energy, and I'll be late in 1 minute. So I'll see you guys tomorrow.